Sure, okay, I'm sure. Okay, everyone, welcome. Finally, 20 minutes late, I think we're ready. So it's not going to be recorded, apparently. So because of that, I don't want to continue with the Brahmajala Sutta, because it is a sequence of talks, and if it isn't recorded, people won't be able to watch the next session. So I'm just going to skip that and just do something else instead. So I hope you're okay with that. So I just picked a random sutta. The random sutta is called Rebuke to Mara. Yeah, Mara Tajaniya Sutta. And it's kind of a nice and entertaining sutta. So we'll have a look at that one and see what comes out of it. So let's just fire away here. So this is Bhante Sujato's translation. So I have heard. At one time, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was staying in the land of the Bhagas on the Crocodile Hill in the deer park at Besakala's wood. At that time, Moggallana was walking meditation in the open air. So here you have the idea of walking meditation, going back all the way to the time of the Buddha or soon afterwards. The Pali word for walking meditation is chankama. And this is a word I think you still have in Sri Lanka. Is that right? You have the word chankama in Sri Lanka? Yeah? What do you call it? Okay, close enough, yeah? So I think actually in Thailand too, they have a similar kind of word which they use. So he was walking in meditation. And what happened was that now at that time, Mara, the wicked one, had got inside Moggallana's belly. Moggallana thought, why now is my belly so very heavy? Like I've just eaten a load of beans. Then he stepped down from the walking path, entered his dwelling, and sat down on the seat spread out, and investigated inside himself. And he saw that Mara the wicked had got inside his belly. So he said to Mara, come out, wicked one, come out. Do not harass the realized one or his disciple. Don't create lasting harm and suffering for yourself. So here you have the idea, even Mara is creating bad karma, yeah, by doing bad things to good people. So everyone is in the same boat, doesn't matter who you are. And Mara thought, this ascetic doesn't really know me or see me when he tells me to come out. Not even the teacher will recognize me so quickly. So how could a disciple? Then Moggallana said to Mara, I know you even when you're like this, wicked one. Do not think he does not know me. You are Mara the wicked, and you think this ascetic doesn't really know me or see me when he tells me to come out. Not even the teacher could recognize me so quickly. So how could a disciple him? Then Mara thought, this ascetic doesn't really know me and see me when he comes out. Ooh, yeah. Does know me, sorry, does know me and see him exactly when he comes out. Then Mara came out of Moggallana's mouth and stood against the door bar. Moggallana saw him there and said, I see you even there, wicked one. Do not think he doesn't see me. That's you, wicked one, standing against the door bar. So this is the background and of this story. So we have Mahamoggallana, obviously the Buddha's left-hand disciple. Yeah, so you see when you see a Buddha statue, you have Moggallana on the left and you have the Venerable Sariputta on the right usually here. And so here he is kind of telling Mara off for making bad karma and doing bad things. And this is one of the themes that you find in the suttas, this idea that Mara is always creating trouble, always trying to stop awakening from happening, trying to bind beings to samsara. Yeah. And obviously the chief disciples of the Buddha, Venerable Sariputta, Venerable Mahamoggallana, they would have been important targets for Mara, because they would be the people who precisely help beings getting out of samsara. So Mara is kind of trying to stop them, I suppose, trying to do bad things. I don't know why he's going into his belly. It's a bit weird, but anyway, I guess any trick in the book is acceptable if you're trying to stop awakening. So that might be one of those things. Yeah. He knows.
Mm.
Is it? Yeah. I think it depends. It depends on what kind of view you have. You can be reborn in those realms with all kinds of views, you know. You can get reborn in the Brahma realm with eternalist views. And if you have an eternalist view, you don't really have a proper understanding of karma. In the sutta just before this one, the Brahma Nimantika Sutta, the Brahma thinks that he's eternal. And of course, if you think that you are eternal, then you don't have an understanding of karma, because karma and rebirth must go together. Yeah. Yeah. So exactly. So there's all kinds of views are possible. I'm not sure if Mara understands karma, to be honest with you. I think it's very quite unlikely. But I don't know. But I think that's kind of irrelevant for the story. He does bad things, whether he believes it or not. He does bad things. You know, the delusion goes to very high levels. So. Okay. So this is kind of a standard fare in the suttas. This fight, almost not fight. This kind of spiritual battle between the Buddha and the monastics and Mara, who tries to do the opposite of what they are doing here. And then when the Mahamoggallana tells a story to Mara, once upon a time, wicked one, I was a Mara named Dusi, and I had a sister named Kali. You were her son, which made you my nephew. That's very interesting, isn't it? At that time, Kakusanda, the blessed one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha, arose in the world. Kakusanda had a fine pair of chief disciples named Vidura and Sanjiva. Of all the disciples of Buddha Kakusanda, none were equal to Venerable Vidura in teaching the Dhamma, and that's how he came to be known as Vidura. Dura means persistent or something which stands or remains. I guess he kind of kept on teaching the Dhamma or something like that. I'm not sure about that one now. That's Duva. Yeah. Anyway, not sure why it's called Vidura, but there must be some connection there between the meaning of the name and the teaching of the Dhamma. But when Venerable Sanjiva had gone to the wilderness or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, he easily attained the cessation of perception and feeling. So one was a master meditator and one was kind of the profound teacher of the Dhamma. That seems to have been the two specialities of these two chief disciples. And the cessation of perception and feeling, this is kind of the highest sort of meditative attainment you can have in Buddhism. It's a very special kind of attainment, also known as Sanya Vedita Nirodha. Actually, that's what it is here. It's also known as just Nirodha cessation. And the idea behind this one, when feeling and perception cease, then everything goes. Without feelings and perceptions, there is no possibility of having any kind of consciousness or anything at all. Because feeling, perception, and consciousness, the three of them always have to go together. You cannot have consciousness without these two other things. And this is one of the differences in Buddhism between the Buddhist teaching and all the other teachings of the world, essentially. And one of the things that you find in independent origination, you find that nama-rupa depends on vijnana, vijnana depends on nama-rupa. Consciousness depends on name, nama-rupa, name and form. These are, if you like, the other aspects of existence, including perception and feeling and all of these things. So consciousness depends on that. It cannot exist without that. So when we're talking about the cessation of perception and feeling, we're talking about the cessation of everything, including consciousness itself. So mind basically ceasing here. And so this is the highest you can reach, because obviously when everything ceases, you cannot go any deeper than that. You have found, gone to the deepest possible emptiness, if you like, or calm on the Buddhist path that is possible to attain. So that's why this is kind of emphasized here, I think, because if he was a master meditator, that would have been the kind of attainment he would have been dwelling in as a consequence. Yeah? I think it said it can last up to 7 days, is what they say. But I don't think it has to last that long. You know, one of the things about the attainments of samadhi is that your ability in samadhi is measured by how easily you attain it, how you come out, how long you stay in that attainment. So it would depend on how your mind inclines before you go in, how long you stay in that one. So that is something you can determine for yourself. But it probably would, even the minimum amount of time probably would be quite long here. Many hours probably at the minimum, up to 7 days. There's a famous story. You know, there's a very, very famous Chinese monk called Empty Cloud. Have you heard about him? Empty Cloud, very, very famous. He was the teacher of many other famous monks. He lived in China, and I'm not sure if he ever left China. He always stayed in China, but he was very famous. Probably. Okay. So, yeah, I went back again. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. This is a long time ago. I'm talking about the story now. Going back to 1920s or 30s, I think. Something like that. Yeah. There is a book. There's a book about him available in English. Okay. Yeah. So he's one of those people. And one of the stories about him is that he, some people came to offer him some food. So they said, "Oh, Master, here's some food." And he said, "Okay, I'll eat it, but I'll just do some meditation first." So he went into meditation, and he kind of was gone for 6 days. He came out. The food was all green and moldy, and it was too late to eat when he came out again. That's one of the stories about it. That's what happens when you go into these deep meditations. Your food gets spoiled. So that's, I don't think he cared too much, probably, but there you are. Okay. All right. Okay, so you know the story already. Okay, good. Okay. Okay, so that was Venerable Sanjiva, who was the master meditator, and he attained easily the cessation of perception and feeling, Sanya Vidaita Niroda. Once upon a time, Sanjiva was sitting at the root of a certain tree, having attained the cessation of perception and feeling. Some cowherds, shepherds, farmers, and passers-by saw him sitting there and said, "It's incredible, it is amazing. This ascetic has passed away while sitting. We should cremate him." That's another disadvantage of these kind of states, is that you become so still, people can't tell the difference anymore, whether you are alive or whether you're dead or what's going on, and no idea. You look dead. But if you feel the body temperature, they're still warm. So that's where they went wrong. They should have felt the body before they decided to cremate him. They collected grass, wood, and cow dung, heaped it all on Sanjiva's body, set it on fire, and left. Then, when the night had passed, Sanjiva emerged from that attainment, shook out his robes, and since it was morning, he robed up and entered the village for alms. Those cowherds, shepherds, farmers, and passers-by saw him wandering for alms and said, "It's incredible! It is amazing! This ascetic passed away while sitting, and now he has come back to life." That's how he came to be known as Sanjiva. The reason is because jiva means to live. It's an Indian word for liver. So Sanjiva literally means something like the survivor or the one who lives. That's kind of what it means. So he became known as the survivor. So you can see that it's kind of fascinating. You set him on fire, he doesn't burn up. And all you do is that you get up afterwards, you shake out your robes, because probably there's a bit of ash on your robes, so you kind of get rid of the ash. And then when you get rid of the ash, then you kind of walk on. And the idea is apparently that when you go into this attainment, not only is your body protected, but even your robes are protected. Nothing happens to your robes. All you have is a bit of ash afterwards. get rid of the ash, and then you go. So is that possible? Can you burn a physical body like that and nothing happens? Does that make sense? Yeah. That's even more amazing, isn't it? Exactly. Yeah. So what do you think? Huitong? You have the faith? Okay. Yeah, so okay, good. Yeah. So I don't know the answer, to be honest. I have no idea. Yeah. So the idea that the robes don't burn, I think it is from the commentary. But it looks like it is implied here as well. Yeah, you just shake out your robes and then you walk on. So there's something going on. That's interesting. Yeah, we don't know because the power of the mind is such. You don't actually know what happens to the body in this kind of situation. So it's kind of interesting here. So there's some weird and wonderful things in the world. In the end, I don't think we will know until we get someone who gets into cessation and perception and feeling, then we can try it out. So does you want to volunteer if you get into this attainment? See what happens. Okay. So I don't think we should try though, because the karma is very bad karma. So we should avoid it. So even if you get into deep meditation like that, we're not going to do anything because the karma for us will be so bad. So we will leave you alone. But it's very rare to have people to get into these kind of attainments. Yeah, these are really profound, and you have to be pretty much a non-returner to get into these kind of attainments. Because you know, once you get to that point, it means that you, when there's nothing left at all, then you have very, very clear understanding of the nature of reality when everything can disappear, and so it's impossible not to have profound insight with that kind of attainment. Yes. I don't think so. I think they were just political statements. Yeah, I doubt that they had set that kind of meditation. I would be surprised, because I think when you come to that point, you're not that interested in politics. You probably wouldn't put yourself, you know, through that kind of ordeal. I would think you have too much compassion for yourself, probably. So yeah. Okay. Then it occurred to Mara Dusi, I don't know the course of rebirths of these ethical mendicants of good character. Why don't I take possession of these Brahmins and householders and say, come, all of you, abuse, attack, harass, and trouble the ethical mendicants of good character. Hopefully by doing this, we can upset their minds so that Mara Dusi can find a vulnerability. And that's exactly what he did. So the idea here is that Mara Dusi, he is going to make the householders and Brahmins and all of them do something upsetting to these disciples so that he can somehow find a vulnerability. In other words, he can kind of somehow attack them, or whatever. That's sort of the idea here. Then those Brahmins and householders abused, attacked, harassed, and troubled those ethical mendicants of good characters. These shavelings, fake ascetics, riffraff, black spawn from the feet of our kinsmen, say, we practice absorption meditation, we practice absorption meditation, and they meditate and concentrate and contemplate and ruminate. They're just like an owl on a branch which meditates and concentrates and contemplates and ruminates as it hunts a mouse. They're just like a jackal on a riverbank which meditates and concentrates and contemplates and ruminates as it hunts a fish. They're just like a cat by an alley or a drain or a dustbin which meditates or concentrates and contemplates and ruminates as it hunts a mouse. They're just like an unladen donkey by an alley or a drain or a dustbin, which meditates and concentrates and contemplates and ruminates. In the same way, these shavelings, these fake ascetics, these riffraff, black spawn from the kinsmen, feet of our kinsmen, say, we practice absorption meditation, we practice absorption meditation, but actually they just meditate, concentrate, contemplate, and ruminate. So, they're trying to get these monks to get upset, yeah? So this is just a way of irritating them or of abusing them. And this is kind of a standard set of terms that is used in the suttas if you want to upset a mendicant. Mundaka is like someone with a shaven head, but it has a kind of a negative connotation to it. Samanaka is like a sort of ascetic, yeah, a fake ascetic, if you like. A samana is the real ascetic, and we have the ka ending, which makes it into a fake or dodgy ascetic. Ibba, riffraff, that's good. And then we have the bandupada paccha, born from the feet of the kinsmen. Yeah, the idea here is that the Brahmins of ancient India and the Brahmins even of the present day, they consider themselves the kinsmen, yeah, the family members of the great Brahma, the god Brahma. And that's why they call the god Brahma their kinsmen, because he's like their father, and all the Brahmins, they are descendants of that, of him or it or whatever Brahma is. And according to the ancient Brahmanical ideas, is that depending on what kind of caste you were, everyone was born of Brahma, but you would be born of different parts of Brahma, depending on who you were. So the Brahmins were born of Brahma's mouth, yeah, the highest Brahma. The Kshatriyas, the kind of the warriors or the aristocrats or whatever you want to call them, they were born from Brahma's kind of breast, yeah. And then you have the workers were from the merchants were from his belly, I think, yeah? And then the ordinary workers from his thighs. And then the lowest of all, the kind of the outcast, they were born from Brahma's feet. Yeah, that's why they're called the black spawn. Yeah, they are dark, and because they kind of come from the feet of the Brahma. This is a kind of a term of abuse in ancient India. And then you have the sequence here of they meditate, concentrate, contemplate, and ruminate. And this is again a sequence of words which are related to the word jayati. Jayati is the same word as jhana, but it's the verbal form, so it means like to practice jhana, yeah, or to meditate if you like. And then this is then a kind of a sequence of verbs which have that as the basis. The verbs in Pali is jayati, pajayati, nijayati, appajayati. These are like kind of negative words with negative connotation based on the word jayati or meditation. So it's like a way of putting down the meditation practice. Elsewhere in the suttas you find, I think Venerable Ananda saying that the monks, when they practice badly, yeah, they pajayati and jayati, that's when you practice meditation with the five hindrances. Yeah, your mind is all over the place, being distracted and all of that. And that is a consequence of hindrances, and that's when this kind of thing is used. But then when the hindrances are gone, that's when it's called real jhana or jayati, the meditation praised by the Buddha being the four jhanas and not anything else really. Yeah. So, all of these people abusing the monks. Then it says, most of the people who died at that time, when their body broke up after death, were reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, or hell. So this is another interesting phrase here, because these people were possessed by Mara. Yeah, Mara was kind of taking them over and directing them and whatever. And now it looks like the kamma still is very bad. And this is kind of strange, yeah, because if they weren't in charge of their mind, if they didn't have any intentions, without intention you can't make bad kamma, then you wouldn't expect it to be bad kamma in this way. Because I just chose a sutta at random, I haven't really had a chance to look at the parallels to this sutta, because there are chart parallels in Chinese to this particular sutta. But I seem to recall that the Chinese parallel is a bit different. I can't remember when I last read this. It was years ago, but that's my vague recollection, that there was a difference here in the Chinese, and that actually they didn't have this bad destination precisely because they weren't responsible for their actions. They didn't have any intentions. Yeah. So there's two possibilities here. One possibility is that the Mara just directed them a little bit, and they still had a lot of intention of their own. Yeah, Mara didn't fully kind of push them to do these things, in which case they were still making bad karma. Or alternatively, if Mara was fully in charge and they didn't have any intentions, then there must be then this is doesn't really make any sense. So either one of those would be appropriate, I think, a way of looking at this. It's one of the interesting things is that sometimes when you find anomalies like this in the suttas, it's actually very useful to look at the parallel versions, because then you see that very often those anomalies are sorted out. Yeah, you find that they actually the parallel versions are different, and so this kind of thing would be a typical thing that would look different in a parallel version. Can you hear me, Hutong, properly? Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, good, yeah, just checking. Okay, then Kakusanda, the Blessed One, the Perfected One, the fully awakened Buddha, addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, the Brahmins and householders have been possessed by Mara Dusi. He told them to abuse you in the hope of upsetting your minds so he can find a vulnerability. Come, all you mendicants, meditate, spreading a heart full of love to one direction, to the second, to the third, and so forth. In the same way, above, below, across, everywhere, all around, spread a heart full of love to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. Meditate spreading a heart full of compassion, a heart full of rejoicing, a heart full of equanimity, to one direction, the second, the third, and the fourth, in the same way, above, below, across, and everywhere, all around, spreading a heart full of equanimity to the whole world, abundant, expansive, limitless, free of enmity and ill will. When those mendicants were instructed and advised by the Buddha Kakusanda in this way, they went to a wilderness, to a root of a tree, or to an empty hut, where they meditated, spreading a heart full of love, full of compassion, full of rejoicing, and full of equanimity. So the idea here, of course, is that to counteract Mara the Dusi, and the way to counteract that is then to have a sense of metta, because if you have a heart of metta, there's no way you're ever going to get upset with anything. And you find this in this beautiful sutta, the Kakachupama Sutta, the simile of the soul, where they compare the idea of metta when you develop it fully, that it is impossible to ruffle you in any way whatsoever. And they have those very memorable similes, and they say it's like someone coming to the river Ganges, and they have a grass torch, and they say, I will burn away, evaporate the whole river Ganges with this grass torch. Yeah, it's not going to work, right? Have you seen the river Ganges? It's big, yeah, it's really, really big. It's like 2 kilometers wide. It depends a bit where you are, of course, but it's massive. And if you have a grass torch, you're not going to make much headway at all. We're trying to evaporate, getting rid of the river Ganges. So in the same way, if you really have developed your metta fully, then regardless of what happens, no one is going to be able to affect you, just like you can't affect the river Ganges with a grass torch. Yeah, so very powerful similes there for the power of developing the Brahma Viharas fully. It's amazing. Do you think that's possible to do that? It is, right? It obviously is possible, but it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to really see that, because sometimes we feel that we are a long way from that point. But it's actually very, I don't know, I find it really inspiring that it's possible to develop the mind to that point. I have no doubt that it's possible. You can see it's possible because you can see yourself as you develop over time. You have less defilements. Yeah, you find more of a balance in your own mind. So you know by extrapolating that eventually it will have to go there. But it's actually very inspiring that it's possible to have that kind of mind. It makes you invulnerable. Yeah, the external world doesn't matter so much anymore. And it's a beautiful thing that this is possible. Yeah. Mm. Well, it doesn't have an effect in the sense that it won't give rise to any defilements in your mind, yeah? Yeah. 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 You, yeah. 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 Pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. But you have to keep up the meditation, right? If you don't meditate and you stop, the effect of the meditation will only last so long, and then it will decline again, and then eventually you will get upset again. But if you keep it up and you keep that state, as long as you have that state of mind, it's impossible for you to be affected by it. Yeah. That's what it says. Yeah. Yeah, of course, when you become an arahant, then it's kind of permanent. So, yeah. Well, you have the simile of the soul in the same sutta. Yeah, that's why it's called the simile of the soul, the whole that sutta. So, based on that. Anyway, I don't know. I just find this really nice and very inspiring and very kind of... it kind of gives you an idea of the power of these teachings and the Dhamma when you see these kind of things. But you will notice there also says that they will go to a wilderness, yeah, the root of a tree or an empty hut. And again, the idea, if you want to meditate fully and really go deep, then it always happens in seclusion. It is when you are secluded that you are really able to withdraw from the world. If you're too close to the world, it is very hard to achieve these kind of states of mind. You have the kaya viveka, seclusion of the body, then leading to the citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind. This is a standard kind of sequence in the suttas. So you need to kind of withdraw from the noise, the bustle, the attachments, the sensory input and all that kind of stuff. And then it's possible to go to these states. Of course, it becomes impossible for Mara to reach these monks anymore, and eventually Mara was going to have to give up. Then it occurred to Mara Dusi, even when I do this, I don't know the course of rebirth of these ethical mendicants of good characters. Why don't I take possession of these Brahmins and householders and say, come all of you, honor, respect, esteem, and venerate the ethical mendicants of good character. Hopefully by doing this we can upset their minds so that the Mara Dusi can find a vulnerability. And that's exactly what he did. So now he's trying the opposite thing, trying to, instead of kind of making them upset, to make them sort of proud and puffed up by honor and gains and all of that. That's kind of the idea here. And then you will gain that vulnerability, because then they become greedy, or they become, right? So it opens up another kind of defilement, the defilement of desire rather than the defilement of anger. Then those Brahmins and householders honored, respected, esteemed, and venerated the ethical mendicants of good character. Most of the people who died at that time, when their body broke up after death, were reborn in a good place, in the heavenly realm. So here again we have this idea that they get reborn in the heavenly realm. Yeah. So we have to assume that they have a little bit of intention left, otherwise that wouldn't really be possible according to the ideas of karma. Alternatively, this may have a different reading in alternative versions of the sutta, perhaps. Then Kakusanda, the Blessed One, the Perfected One, the Fully Awakened Buddha, addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, the Brahmins and householders, have been possessed by Mara Dusi. He told them to venerate you in the hope of upsetting your minds so they can find the vulnerability Come, all you mendicants, meditate, observing the ugliness of the body, perceiving the repulsiveness of food, perceiving dissatisfaction with the whole world, and observing the impermanence of all conditions. And these are some of the important perceptions or meditations that you find in the suttas. Yeah, this is the asubha practice that you have there, ugliness of the body. You have the ahare patikula sanye, which is seeing the repulsiveness of food. Yeah, the food kind of not being as interesting as it may seem. You have the famous the perception of the sabbaloke anabiratta sanye, which is seeing the dissatisfaction with the whole world, seeing how the whole world is kind of out of control and changing. There's nothing to hold on to in the whole world. And then the last one, sabba sankaresu anicchanupassi, seeing the impermanence in all sankaras. Let's take it even further. That's also not just seeing the whole world, but also your own five aggregates as impermanent. So this is a different kind of focus, because if you are proud because someone honors you or whatever, then that pride is very often based on the perception of something being permanent, something that you can hold on to. You can somehow hold on to that pride, hold on to that honor that you have, or that positive feedback you're getting from the world. Of course, if you remember impermanence, remember that whatever honor you're getting now, as soon as it arises, it will disappear again. And tomorrow it might be gone. Tomorrow, whatever else will happen. And then these things are much less interesting when you remember the idea of impermanence. None of these things are really there for you to hold on to or take. Just like in this life, everything we own in this life will have to go when we die. Yeah, it's kind of one of those basic realities of existence that we forget so much. And the same thing, all the honor and praise we get in this life, that too will die, will disappear the moment we die, because it all belongs to this world. It's a part of this world. So the idea of impermanence is a powerful antidote to attaching to these kind of things, and very important. Obviously, it's so easy to go astray with these kind of things, especially if you are a very kind of charismatic guru. And sometimes you see these really charismatic gurus with large followings, and they end up doing crazy things because they get too much honor, too much being worshipped, all kind of people. And in the end, it just destroys them as people. And so this then is a way to counteract that, remember the impermanence of these things. So quite nice teachings, actually. But I'm not going to go any further, I think. I think we'll just leave it at that. The Buddha Kakusandu. I'm just getting ahead of myself. When those mendicants were instructed and advised by the Buddha Kakusanda in this way, they went to the wilderness again, to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, where they meditated, observing the ugliness of the body, perceiving the repulsiveness of food, perceiving dissatisfaction with the whole world, and observing the impermanence of all conditions, or all phenomena, if you like. Then the Buddha Kakusandu robed up in the morning, and taking his bowl and robe, entered the village for alms with Venerable Vidura as his second monk. Then Maradusi took possession of a certain boy, picked up a rock and hit Vidura on the head, cracking it open. Then Vidura, with blood pouring from his cracked skull, still followed behind the Buddha Kakusanda. Then the Buddha Kakusanda turned his whole body, the way that elephants do, to look back, saying, "This Maradusi knows no bounds." And with that look, Maradusi fell from that place and was reborn in the great hell. So this is the elephant look. It's famous. It's kind of one of the ways that a Buddha is supposed to, instead of turning just his head, you turn around the whole body. And the idea, I think, is, I guess it's like almost like a dignified way, perhaps, of looking back, or something like that. And this is where the Buddha is supposed to have done this, the Buddha Gautama also doing the same thing. And so this just shows you the karmic results, yeah, of attacking one of the chief disciples of the Buddha. And this is what happens. You kind of bang, you go straight away to get reborn in the great hell. It is interesting because sometimes we talk about whether there is such a thing as the Antarabhava, an intermediate existence. They're one of those big debates they had in Buddhism. Different schools disagreed on this. And again, it depends on the kind of karma that you make. You can see here, he made very powerful karma. And by being reborn directly in hell, there is no Antarabhava in that case. You just go bang into hell because the karma is so strong. There's no need for any intermediate period. In the same way, if you have very good karma, if you have attained samadhi or whatever, and as you go through the dying process, you enter that state of samadhi, then you kind of go directly again into that existence in your next life, into a samadhi existence. But for all those intermediate existences, if the karma isn't so strong, then you will tend to go, it looks like from the suttas, to more like an intermediate state for a while, before you then go on to the karma kind of ripens properly, and then you go on to your next life later on. Okay, wow, now comes a description of the great hell. Are you ready for this? This may not be so nice, I have to warn you. I don't think it's too much. There are other suttas which have a long description of the hell realms, but this one is, I think, quite a short one, so we probably can deal with this. Maybe it's good that there's no one online today, because this might be too much for some of those online audiences. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. The great hell, Maha Niraya, I don't know. I have no idea. I guess, yeah. That's what it's called anyway, the great hell, yeah. That's the name of it, called the great hell. I don't know what it implies. I haven't studied the hells in great detail. It's not my favorite topic. The great hell is known by three names. The six fields of contact, the impaling with spikes, and also individually painful. So the six fields of contact. I think the idea here is that whatever contact you have, six fields means the six senses. So whatever contact you have in that realm, everything is painful. So you can imagine what that is like when everything is painful. It's pretty despairing very quickly if that's the case. You really don't want to get reborn into one of these places. Impaling with stakes, so I think that's pretty obvious what that means. I don't really have to describe that any further. And individually painful, pachatta, internally. I would say internally painful, actually. Pachatta means internally or relating to oneself. Maybe individually. Maybe it means that you are, I don't know what it means. Maybe it means that you are just kind of lonely as well. You're kind of by yourself. You're just pain. You're kind of wandering around in the by yourself, completely alone, and it's all painful at the same time. Anyway, it sounds pretty dismal. Then the wardens of hell came to me and said, when steak meets steak in your heart, you will know that you have been roasting in hell for 1,000 years. I roasted for many years, many centuries, many millennia in the great hell. Of course, because this is Mahamoggallana, he's reflecting back. He was Maradussi in the past life. So this is why. For 10,000 years I roasted in the annex of the great hell, experienced the pain called coming out. This is like emerging from hell. You have to go through this this other thing here. My body was in human form, but I had the head of a fish. What kind of hell was that where Maradussi was roasted after attacking the disciple Vidura along with the Brahmin Kakusanda? Brahmin here meaning like Brahmin used in the sense of someone of the highest kind of caste, someone special in that sense. There were 100 iron spikes, each one individually painful. That's the kind of hell where Dussi was roasted after attacking the disciple Vidura along with the Brahmin Kakusanda. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering here. There are mansions that last for an eon, standing in the middle of a lake, sapphire-colored, brilliant, they sparkle and shine. Dancing there are nymphs, shining in all different colors. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you'll fall into suffering. It's a bit strange, isn't it? It talks about the mansions, then it talks about the suffering. Okay, well, anyway. I am the one who, encouraged by the Buddha, shook the stilt longhouse of Migara's mother with his big toe as the Sangha of mendicants watched. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering. I am the one who shook the palace of victory. This is the palace of the gods. With his big toe, owing to psychic power, inspiring the deities to awe. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering. I am the one who asked Sakka in the palace of victory, Vasava, do you know the freedom that comes from the ending of craving? I am the one to whom Sakka admitted the truth when asked. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering. I am the one who asked Brahma in the hall of justice before the assembly. Friend, do you still have that same view that you had in the past? Or do you see the radiance transcending the Brahma's realm? And I am the one to whom Brahma truthfully admitted his progress. Good sir, I don't have that view that I had in the past. I see the radiance transcending the Brahma's realm. So how could I say today that I am permanent and eternal? Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who directly knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering. I am the one who touched the peak of Mount Meru, using the power of meditative liberation. I visited the forest of the people who dwell in the eastern continent. Dark one, if you attack a mendicant who knows this, a disciple of the Buddha, you will fall into suffering. Though a fire doesn't think, I'll burn the fool, still the fool who attacks the fire gets burnt. In the same way, Mara, in attacking the realized one, you'll only burn yourself, like a fool touching the flames. Mara's done a bad thing in attacking the realized one. Wicked one, do you imagine that your wickedness won't bear fruit? Your deeds heap up wickedness that will last a long time, Terminator. Forget about the Buddha, Mara, and give up your hopes for the mendicants. That is how, in the Besakala Grove, the mendicant rebuked Mara, the spirit downcast disappeared right there. So the idea here is that Venerable Mahamoggallana, he is kind of recalling some of the things that he did during his life, as a great disciple. And he's kind of telling Mara, if you attack someone with these kind of powers, well, you're in trouble, because this is a very powerful person with a very developed mind. And if you attack someone like that, then the karmic consequences are really, really quite bad. Some of these things, I don't really know what they refer to. But we have some of these things here, some of the verses here. One is about the stilt house of Migara's mother. Migara's mother, that's Visakha. That is the Buddha's number one female lay disciple. And she shook the house. And I think the idea, the story there, there's a number of stories actually with Mahamoggallana. One is that when he actually helped to build that house, this was supposed to be a big mansion or a large house on stilts, and it was built very, very rapidly because he used his psychic powers to kind of help the building work. So kind of rocks would just fly up into place, bang, bang, that kind of stuff. So very efficient way of building if you have psychic powers. But then at a certain point, there were some of the mendicants were getting a bit lazy or arguing too much or doing whatever. So sometimes they needed a bit of a wake-up call. So Mara would come with his famous big toe, and he would just touch the house with the big toe, and the whole house would shake when he touched it with the big toe. That was the power of Mahamoggallana. Yeah, so he's telling Mara, well, if someone with that kind of power, should you mess with that kind of person? Probably not, yeah? Stay back, Mara, otherwise you are in serious trouble. That's what's going on here. And then he, in the next verse here, then he did even better, because then he went up to the heavenly realm, to the Tavatingsa realm, where Sakka is in charge. And then he went to Sakka's palace in the Tavatingsa Loka, and he did exactly the same there. He had to wake Sakka up from his slumber, because Sakka was getting complacent. Sakka was just indulging in sensual pleasures and messing around and having a good time and building palaces left, right, and center. That's what happens in heaven. You just build palaces. Yeah, that's kind of what gods do. Build a palace here, build a palace there. Yeah, and more and more. And then he did the same thing. He had to use his big toe, and he shook the whole palace. And this was a real palace. This was not like a human palace. This was a palace with 700 towers. And in each one there was, I have to look it up now, I can't remember how much there was. There were 7 rooms in each tower, and each room had all these nymphs and all these kind of things. So he shook that whole thing, so it would have been a pretty awesome sight to behold. And then, of course, Sakka came to his senses when he saw that. And then he also asked Sakka, it's the same verse there, he asked him about the ending of craving. And then here, of course, Mahamoggallana is pointing towards his wisdom. The fact that he understands the end of craving, obviously, now it's getting even more profound. Psychic power is one thing, and that's always considered lesser in Buddhism. But the real power of a chief disciple is obviously the power of insight. And the highest of insight is the ending of craving itself, because it means you are an arahant. Should you mess with arahants? No, because arahants are, they are very powerful in that sense, and you have to be very careful. I don't know if you have ever, if you meet people who are very special like that, and who seem to be very powerful and very pure, you don't really want to mess with them. Yeah, it feels wrong, because you can feel the purity in this person. You can feel the kindness and everything. And to mess around with someone who is so kind, it seems completely crazy, unless you are on a really bad power trip or something. Then you might want to mess with people like that. But otherwise, you should really hold back. And for most people, it comes quite naturally. And you can understand why that would be such bad karma. Yeah, you can meet someone who's really, really pure, and you want to do something bad to them, you can almost intuitively feel why that is really bad, because it's such a pure person. So trust your intuition sometimes, but only trust your intuition when your mind is pure. Don't trust your intuition if you're on a power trip, because then you're going to do bad things. And then you had also Mahamoggallana going to Brahma's realm. So all of these various things are mentioned here. About that he did, and it kind of talked about in suttas in various places. And then at the very end, he says that, wicked one, you imagine that your wickedness won't bear fruit. So it looks like he didn't really understand the kamma all that well. Didn't really understand what was going on. And then he says, your deeds heap up wickedness that will last a long time. Terminator. Isn't that interesting? Terminator? Yeah, I think those movies, they were named after one of the suttas, I think. I think that was the most likely one. Because the word here for Terminator is antaka. And anta means end. Yeah, so it is literally an end maker. Yeah, you make an end of something. So, of course, Ajahn Sujato being Ajahn Sujato, he's not happy with end make. He needs something more kind of powerful. Yes, a terminator is the word that he uses. Yeah, and it's good. Yeah, you terminate things and make an end of things. I think it's quite nice. So Arnold Schwarzenegger, he got his inspiration from the suttas, like everyone else. Yeah, everyone is inspired by the suttas. So that makes sense. Antakaro, making an end of things. Bill. Yeah, that it doesn't say. It doesn't say. But maybe they were. Yeah, so. Again, it would depend on whether he had an intention or not. But so if you had some bad intentions, it might have not been such a good idea. Yeah. But if you didn't have an intention, I would say nothing should have happened. Yeah. It's a little bit strange the way this is phrased in the sutta. You wonder what is going on. But anyway. Yeah. That's the thing. It depends on how much intention he had, yeah. Whether he was completely taken over by Mara, or whether the Mara was, you know, it depends on your intention. So I guess it's fascinating because there's two intentions, or you know, the way kamma works. It depends on whether it comes entirely from yourself or whether you are pushed, prompted from the outside. And even if you are prompted from the outside, it's still bad karma because you are still doing it yourself. It's just that you are influenced by an external force. So I guess the point here probably is that you are just influenced by the external force, but ultimately you still have that intention. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be able to say those things or do those things. Yeah. So, probably the karma is less because your intention will be weaker. If it comes fully from yourself, it will be a stronger intention, yeah? Because I am doing it, I decide on this. If it comes from the outside, it's more like probably a slightly weaker kind of intention. But yeah, that might very well be what is going on there. Seems, yeah. Yeah. Both people get bad karma, yeah. So you, by inciting the person, also the person doing it, yeah. This is one of the things about the suttas. If you want to live an ethical life, not only should you be ethical yourself, you should also teach other people, you should encourage other people to be ethical. This is one of the aspects of ethics, actually, to encourage others, yeah. 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 Probably, yeah. It depends. It doesn't say very clearly how they are influenced. So let's say that Mara possesses the person. Well, if you possess the person fully, I would say you're no longer in charge of your faculties at all. Then Mara is in charge. Yeah? That's Mara's intention. Because, you know, people black out completely. They don't know what's going on anymore. And then the possession is finished and they come back. Now, this is, experience that people sometimes have. But if you have no idea what is going on, you're not responsible. So it's a bit unclear here what is going on, what actually is happening here. So it depends on, I think the word possession is used, so it's a bit of a grey area, yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Yes, sir. Mount Meru. Where is Mount Meru? Okay. Yeah, Sumeru or Meru or whatever it is, something that you sometimes find. Some people say that Mount Meru is found in, you have the various kind of realms in Buddhism. So if you go to the Tavatingsa realm, that's where you can find Mount Meru, or maybe the Tattu Maharajika Devas, the four great kings of that realm. So they say that some of these geographical features that I've mentioned in the sutta are found in those particular realms. It could also be these are things that are leftovers from ancient Indian mythology, because India had a lot of mythology. You know, in India they had these ideas of fights between the Asuras and the Devas that existed before the time of the Buddha, and then it was brought into Buddhism as well. And Sumeru, I think, is one of those things that existed in those ancient mythology, and it was added to the Buddhist suttas. It would not be a physical mountain in India, no. Does it exist at all? Does it exist in these alternative realities? Maybe, yeah. Maybe when you get reborn in Vincent, right? Vincent? Yeah? When you get reborn in Tavatingsa Vincent, you check it out, see if you can find Sumeru out there. Yeah, it's possible. It's possible that these things are part of the expanded world. I was going to look at some other suttas today. I had some other suttas prepared because that was what I was going to do. And one of those suttas had this nice idea about the what is called the Loka Dhatu. Loka is world. Dhatu is like an element. So it's like a solar system or something like that. Yeah. And every Loka Dhatu has one earth, one sun, a moon. Yeah, and then it has all the various realms in that Loka Dhatu. It has the human realm. It has the four great kings. It has the gods of the 33. It has the Yama Loka, Tusita Loka. What's it called again? Nimitta. Anyway, the two highest worlds. All the six realms belonging to the sensual realm, and then also the Brahma Loka, and they are all the kind of belong to the solar system. They're all somehow held together somehow, yeah? So Mount Meru might be, it's almost like it might be right here, but it's only visible if you kind of go to the Tavatinsa realm, yeah? It's part of that realm in a sense. Not Arupa Loka, because Arupa Loka is even higher, but it's a fine material realm, you could say, or something like that, yeah, yeah. That's what it looks like. It looks like a Loka Dhatu is like roughly equivalent to a solar system, because they talk about Earth, Sun, and Moon. Yeah, it sounds like a solar system. And then every time there is like a Earth or, you know, a similar kind of planet with our people or whatever, you have all of these layers, yeah? And then beyond that, you have the higher gods, Mahabrahma, who might be a god for the whole thing, yeah? Yeah, for the whole kind of the whole thing. It's an interesting study I was saw recently. It's a study about the universe and the structure of the universe. And according to this study, the structure of the universe, in other words, how the matter in the universe is distributed and the forces in the universe are distributed, looks almost exactly like the brain. That's an interesting thing, right? So the structure of the universe, if you look at how the, you know, if you light it up in such a way that you can see the matter, how it stretches out, and the forces of the universe, how they interact, and the connections and the kind of the how this whole thing hangs together looks almost exactly like a brain, like the synapses, yeah, and how the synapses are held together in the brain is very, very similar. And so some people were arguing that the universe is like the mind of Mahabrahma or something like that, yeah, because Mahabrahma is the Mahabrahma of the whole universe, perhaps, yeah. So that maybe the mind of Mahabrahma is then visible through how we see the universe, in the same way that you can have some insight into the human mind by looking at the human brain. Interesting. Is that too interesting? Or that's a bit too interesting. So, but anyway, I thought it was a fascinating similarity. I don't know, maybe it's just purely coincidental or purely kind of irrelevant. But it was an interesting thing that there should be such similarity between the two. Huh? Yeah. 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 He would have been, yeah. 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 I think they are probably mind made. Yeah, that's what I think. I think that's the only sensible way to think about them. Really, that they are mind made. So, even if they are mind made, it might still be that when you go there, you might meet similar people who also mind make their own realm. Yeah, and you kind of still there still might be other beings there somehow. Well, it probably feels like you're physically there. That's what it feels like to you, but it might still be mind-made, even though it feels like you're physically there. Huh? So it's like this, many of the Brahma realms also are mind-made realms, but when you are there, it probably feels like a physical realm, much like the human realm. But the difference is that because it's mind-made, the moment your mind changes, let's say that you have a moment of loving-kindness or whatever, then bang, you spring out of hell straight away. There's nothing to hold you there. There's no kind of, because of mind-made. But in the human realm, when your mind changes, you're still stuck here because this physical body of ours is not mind-made. It is more, it kind of holds us into this existence for that life. That's really the difference. That's part exactly. So that would be the not the hell realm, but more like the Peta Loka. Yeah, so that is probably also mind made. So similar kind of thing. You do something good for them, they feel happy, and bang, they spring out. They kind of come out of the Peta Loka straight away, and they get somewhere else. Yeah. I think probably it feels like 1,000 years. I can imagine it would feel like 1,000 years very quickly with that kind of suffering. But I suspect it is from the perspective of the beings that are there. I would think. Oh, no, it would have been long after, because he would have killed it. I mean, here he's already an arahant. Don't know. No idea. You probably have to search some of the commentaries to find out about that. Sub-commentaries. Not sure. He did some bad things, Mahamogran, didn't he? He did some bad things in the past. Exactly. Fascinating, isn't it? That's the thing. So it's interesting how some people can actually do a lot of bad things, and how human beings are so complicated. You have the negative qualities and the positive qualities at the same time, and you kind of get distracted by doing some bad stuff, to say the least, for a long time, and then you quickly get back on the path again because the underlying qualities are there and just waiting to mature. It is very fascinating here. And that's why you have to be very careful sometimes with judging other people, because sometimes you can go really wrong if you judge people in the wrong way. That's what they say. There's only one Buddha at a time in one world system. So this is like one Loka Dhatu. So in this solar system, only one Buddha. But if you can, travel to another solar system, you might be able to meet the Buddha right now. So some people have suggested that. Just need to, if you can kind of, fly, or you can somewhat reappear in some other solar system, you can actually meet the Buddha. I don't know if that's the best thing to do. We already have the teachings, but it's kind of fascinating.
This story
It's a bit over the top. I don't know how much of this is to be taken literally, and how much of it is to be taken as a legend or a mythology. It is very hard to say. There is no mention of the Buddha at all, so don't really know what is going on with the Buddha here. Exactly. So usually when it says what the Buddha is, then usually it means that the Buddha is still alive. If it doesn't say anything about the Buddha, it could mean that the Buddha has already passed away. Supposedly, however, Venerable Mahamoggallana supposedly passed away before the Buddha. So that doesn't fit with that part. So there is a bit of uncertainty here. I don't know how to, how to interpret this sutta, how literally it should be interpreted. This is always one of those things. The Buddha also sometimes uses similes, and he uses stories to teach. And there's always a question how to what extent this should be taken literally or not. Like the Aganya Sutta, a famous sutta from the Digha Nikaya, which talks about the evolution of the world, and how the world evolves, and how you start off in the higher realm, and your body becomes coarser and coarser, and you eat the food that is available, and you become greedy, and kind of things kind of get lower and lower. And is that to be taken literally? Is it a metaphor, an extended metaphor, a simile for something? Is it, these are kind of interesting questions, and I don't think there is any absolute answer, but not everything in the sutta should be taken literally. In fact, the Buddha specifically says that there are certain teachings that are should be taken literally, and others that need to be, you need to extract the meaning from them. They're not literal statements, sayings. And if you get that wrong, then you misunderstand the teaching here. He says that some teachings you need to extract the meaning, other ones they are literally true the way they are. And you have to be able to know the difference, and you have to be able to tell the difference between the two.
So it's not always simple to interpret the suttas in the right way. So you have, there's always a bit of interpretation going on. So you have to be, you have to be careful here. Yeah. Is Mara still around her? Mara is always around her. Yeah, Mara is in here. Yeah, Mara, right here. Oops, Mara. This is the main usage of the word Mara in the suttas is as a metaphor for the defilements of the mind. Yeah, you get pulled by the nose for your own, from your own defilements. That is the main meaning of Mara. Mara is also a deity, but that's a minority thing in the suttas. The far majority is a psychological thing. Yeah. So the tempter inside that pulls in the wrong direction says, yeah, I've got to do this, this is important, forget about the blooming precepts for a while, you know, come back to the precepts tomorrow. That's Mara talking to you. Yeah. Okay. Yes. In the Antrabhava, there isn't any kind of clarity about that. It doesn't say. The Buddha just, you know, the only thing I know is that the sutta, sometimes they talk about an existence in between before you get reborn. It doesn't really say anything about how long. But I suspect there's no reason why it couldn't go on for quite a long time, yeah, depending on the situation. And so, yeah. But the thing is that even if you do get reborn, sometimes you get reborn in the Petaloka as a ghost. And of course, then you can reach the person in the Petaloka regardless. Yeah, so you can always reach people after they're dead. There will always be some of your relatives are going to be in Petaloka because you have so many relatives who go back many, many lives. There's always some relative back there who is who's gone to Petaloka. So if you make good karma for your family or whatever, there's always going to be somebody who benefits from that. That's what the Buddha said. Actually, that's a quote from the suttas. It's not my kind of suggestion. Okay, everyone. Everyone happy? So apologize for the slight delay today and everything, but that's what happens when you have disorganized religion. And so it's good. Anyway, so let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.